Okay, so in the previous lectures, I gave you a nice set of lecture notes. For this lecture, I do not have a nice set of lecture notes. I have my scribbles. But everything important that I'm going to say, I'll write down on the board. And you don't have to copy it down. I don't know if you know, but there's this Pearson website where they post the videos from these lectures. And from there, you can also download a PDF that is screenshots of everything that's written on the blackboard. So that might save you, you know, having to copy things down. Okay. So there are many books on quantum mechanics, right? And they all cover different topics. And some of these topics are dense and long. And there are things, you know, they discuss things like perturbation theory, Dyson series, Magnus series, gauge transformations, Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, which we did yesterday, variational methods, Born-Oppenheimer approximations, rotating wave approximation, and so on and so on. And many of these things are really difficult to master. And they often seem unrelated to each other. And, you know, even if you are really technically proficient and you're able to master all of these things, does that really mean that you understand quantum theory? So maybe it does, but maybe it doesn't. And so what I want to do today is to like strip away all of that stuff and just discuss the fundamental basics of the theory. And so I used to think that I didn't understand quantum mechanics because I struggled with all of the, you know, technical aspects of the theory. And then I started to think about just the basic concepts. And I discovered that I really don't understand quantum theory because it gets really, really, really weird. So we see things like entanglement, for example, which is this phenomenon that if I have two particles and they're entangled, I can send them to the other ends of the universe and they can instantaneously affect each other. I see things like the no-cloning theorem, which tells me that if I have an unknown quantum particle, I can't copy it. There's nothing I can do to make a copy of this particle. I see things that if I have a quantum state and I don't know what this quantum state is, and if I wanted to describe it, I would have to, you know, make an infinite number of measurements. And even if I don't have any means of sending that quantum state from one part of the universe to the other, as long as I have entanglement as a resource, I can teleport that quantum state. I see things like quantum key distribution, which allows me to unconditionally guarantee that I can send a message from one party to another securely without an eavesdropper being able to intercept this message. And I can also make testable predictions that force me to give up some cherished concepts like either locality or free will. And so all of these things are really quite profound, but we can see all of them with just a few really basic concepts. We don't need to you know, use all of this machinery that we've been kind of talking about in the last few lectures. And so in today's lecture, I just want to focus on the fundamental concepts. And I want to construct an infographic that you can use as a guide for when we delve deeper into these concepts in the September lecture. So I'm going to give my lecture on this side of the board, and on that side, we're going to slowly construct this infographic. And that's kind of the important thing that you should take away from it. Okay, so now that it's dry, I can kind of, I just want to draw up a few lines to begin with. Okay, so at the most basic level, we only have three things that are happening. And that is, we can prepare states, we can allow them to evolve, and we can measure them. And that's it, right? So let me just draw a little cartoon to represent that. And so I guess I'll have time going in this way. So state preparation, evolution, and measurement. And so that's why I made three columns here, because here we will have state preparation. Evolution. And measurement. And these three basic concepts can be captured by three postulates that people tend to talk about in quantum mechanics. So just to be a little bit rigorous at the beginning, I want to write down these postulates. And I'm not going to give them numbers because different people present them in different orders depending on what story they would like to tell. So I will just kind of name the postulates without telling you which is the first or second or third. So there is the state-space postulate, which essentially tells you that we have states. But to be rigorous, let's write it down. So associated to any isolated physical system, is a complex vector space with inner product so this is the Hilbert space. And it's known as the state space of the system. And then we can say that the system is completely described by a unit vector in the system's state space. Okay, so what that means is we have a vector psi to represent our state, and our vector is normalized to 1. And so I'm going to give a bunch of examples. And I'm just going to use two-level systems because that's all we need to really capture the interesting phenomena. So for example, if our Hilbert space consists of two basis vectors, then we have a state psi alpha 0 plus beta 1, and we will have this normalization condition. Okay, great. So then the second postulate, no, not second, the next postulate is the evolution postulate. So the evolution of a closed quantum system is described by a unitary transformation so that is if the state psi at time t one state psi at time t1 is related to psi prime at t2. By a unitary operator which depends on T1 and T2. And so throughout this lecture, I'm just going to consider discrete unitary transformations. I'm not going to talk about transformations that depend as a function of time. It's just you'll have an input state and then you will get an output state. So some examples of this. Well, actually, let's first write this up here. So our state prime, which is the output state, is going to be given by a unitary acting on the initial state. And to ensure that it is a unitary, we have to impose this condition. Okay, so some examples of unitaries. So this is a unitary that is going to give a phase on the one component of the state, or another example is a unitary like that, which flips the zero and the one, and also puts a specific phase on one of the states. So we'll encounter some of these in the upcoming course. Okay, and the last one is measurement. So we have a projective measurement. Is described by an observable M, which is a Hermitian operator on the space of the system being observed. and this observable is going to have what's known as a spectral decomposition. Let's write it here. Okay.
The sign should be plus for the second.
It doesn't have to be. So if I get a sigma x and multiply it by a sigma y, I believe I'll get something like that. Maybe not exactly. But I mean, you can make it unitary like that for sure. Okay. And so where PM is the projector, onto the eigenspace of M. With eigenstates, with eigenvalues, M. So the possible outcomes of the measurement are going to correspond to these eigenvalues, M. So some examples. I can say that my measurement is described by the set of projectors PM. And so our projectors correspond to the outcome 0 or 1. And typically, people use the language to measure in the computational basis because often this is discussed in quantum information theory. And so 0 and 1 is the basis they use in computers to do computation. So another example would be the diagonal basis. So if you're thinking about spin half particles, you can think about this as measuring in the sigma z basis, and this is measuring in the sigma x basis. And so pretty much at this stage, we can just stop talking about observables. We don't have to describe our measurements in terms of observables. We can just describe our measurements in terms of measurement operators, or in this case, these projectors. And this allows us to then formulate a much more general theory of measurement, which we're going to do later on in the class. Do you have a question? Yeah. Sure.
The unitary operator you mentioned on the second board.
Are you worried it's not unitary? Maybe I need an I somewhere. But I think. Sorry?
Or square root 2.
I don't think it needs to be.
No. So this is, as a matrix, this is just going to be, it's probably not Hermitian. That might be the problem. I might need an I. It doesn't need to be Hermitian. It's unitary. Yeah, sorry. So I think you can show that times Oops. I hope that's true. I can't do these things in my head when I'm standing here, but I'm gonna guess that that's true. Okay. So we've defined our measurements in terms of measurement operators. In this case, they're projectors. And so let's just write this up in our infographic. So our measurement is described by a set of projectors, PM. They satisfy some properties. So they are going to be Hermitian. So this tells us that they're orthogonal, and also that the square of themselves is equal to itself. Okay, and then we can say that given a measurement described by the operators PM, the probability of getting outcome M is going to be given by expectation value of that operator. And the state given outcome M will be given by P of M acting on the state and then normalized by the probability of getting outcome M. Okay. So all of this is. Well, I won't bother putting anything there yet. Okay, so everything that I've said so far just assumes that we have a single isolated system. But it's possible, of course, to have more than one system. You can have two systems. And quantum mechanics gives us a structure for describing composite system, which is the tensor product structure. So let's say I have a composite system. So the state space of a composite system is the tensor product of the component physical systems. Okay, so again, let's look at a few examples for our two-level systems. So let's say I have a system A, which will be given by Hilbert space A. And let's say the Hilbert space is a two-level system. And then I also have a second particle, particle B, and it has also a two-level Hilbert space. Then I can write a Hilbert space for both particles or both systems as the tensor product And so I could put labels on these, A, B, B, A, B, A, B, and so on. But it's kind of implied that the systems on the left are going to be corresponding to A, and the systems on the right are going to correspond to B. So people often just drop these indices. Another thing you may see people do is combine the two kets. So I could write the same thing as 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. So if you see something like that, that's just exactly the same notation as this. Okay, so what are the consequences of this tensor product structure? So let's consider a situation. Again, we have two systems, and we're going to invite our favorite friends, Alice and Bob, which you'll see come up quite often. And we're going to say that Alice has a system that I'm going to describe by the state A, and Bob has a system in the state B. And we're going to assume that now there's going to be a unitary applied to both of these systems. So it's a joint unitary. They're going to evolve together. So I now have unitary A and B applied on both of the systems. So let's again look at our example. And this time I'm going to say that Alice's state starts in the plus state, and Bob's state is also in the plus state. And the unitary that I'm going to give you in a minute is going to be written in the computational basis. So to make the calculation easy, I'm just going to expand this state in the computational basis. And so that's quite simple. It's just a product of somewhere I've defined. Oh, yeah. So there's the definition for the plus minus states. And I've just taken two of them and expanded it out. And then the two lots of one on root two give me a half out the front. OK, and I'm going to say that the unitary that I'm going to apply to the entire system, it's quite a simple looking unitary. Like that. So you can see that it'll do nothing to the 0, 0 state, nothing to the 0, 1 state, nothing to the 1, 0 state, and then it'll give me a phase of pi for the 1, 1 state. Okay, so let's have a look at what the state looks like after I evolve it according to the composite unitary. So I'm going to denote the state with a prime. And so here I have the unitary AB acting on the initial state AB, which I haven't defined. But this is my... And so what we get is a state that looks like this. Now, I'll just rewrite this state in a couple of different bases just to illustrate a few points in a second. Okay, so all of these are the same state, just written in different bases. And so I can do all sorts of things. I can write in whatever basis I like. But one thing that I cannot do is I cannot find any basis in which I can write this as a tensor product of two states. And so what this tells me is that the state that I have here now is entangled. So by definition, any state, any pure state, and I'll define later what a pure state is, but any pure state that cannot be written as a tensor product of two states is an entangled state. And so let's imagine a situation that, I'll put some labels again, that Alice and Bob share this state. So they had their individual states, they applied some sort of unitary to entangle them. And then Bob decides to go to the moon, right? Because people do that. So to illustrate the consequences of that, I'll just define. So here we have a specific type of entangled state. It turns out to be a maximally entangled state. But I could write a general type of state that's a bipartite state of Alice's and Bob's system. So this general state can be written as alpha 0, 0, beta 0, 1, gamma 1, 0, plus delta 1, 1. So now this general state, all of these coefficients, they can be complex. And depending on what the coefficients are, the state is either separable or it's entangled or whatever. Okay, so now okay, Bob takes his, you know, Alice stays here on Earth, and she has her quantum system, and then Bob goes over here to the moon, and he has his quantum system, and in general, they're entangled. And so Alice has been given a task. Alice has to describe her quantum system. But of course, in general, we know that we can't write the state as a tensor product of Alice's state and Bob's state. So of course, she's going to need Bob's help in order to describe the actual system, actual state of her system. But Bob, you know, he just got to the moon. He doesn't really feel like working, and he decides to go to the moon pub, and he's like not there to help Alice. And Alice has this assignment due, you know, in like 3 hours, and she has to characterize her state. And Bob's there, not, you know, he can't help. And at this stage, it seems like she can't really do anything, but she's going to try and get part marks, and she's going to try and, you know, do as much as she can. And it turns out that quantum mechanics actually allows, that has a formalism that allows Alice to describe just her state, even if it's entangled with Bob's state. And so we can do this through an operation that's known as a partial trace. And in doing so, we create an object that's called a density operator or density matrix. In principle, it's an operator, but which can be represented by a matrix. But in the community, people just use the word density matrix, even though it's not exactly correct. But you can essentially use them interchangeably, and I will probably also say density matrix a lot. Okay, so let's see what happens. So the first thing that you do is you take your bipartite state, and in order to work out what Alice's state is, we have to first write this as a matrix. So you remember that these things were described as vectors. So if I take a outer product of two vectors, I'm going to get something that looks like a matrix. And at this stage, there's no extra information that I've added. I'm just, you know, writing the same thing twice. So this state contains all of the information that my state vector contained, but I'm just representing it differently. So this now is what we call a density matrix. But at the moment, it's a density matrix that describes Alice's and Bob's state. And what we need to do is throw away all the information about Bob's state. And so the mathematical operation that allows you to throw away information is called a partial trace. So we denote it like this. It's like a normal trace, except it's done over only one subsystem rather than both of the systems. And so then, by definition, this gives us a density operator that represents only Alice's system. And so the partial trace, just like a normal trace, is going to be given by a sum of all of the diagonal elements. Where these are just the basis states. But now, rather than summing over all of the diagonal elements of the entire system, I'm just summing over the diagonal elements of system B. So you'll be able to see that if I plugged in this entire state into here, all of these kets would essentially turn all of the kets corresponding to system B into complex numbers, and all I would be left with is an operator that acts on system A. And so you can go through and do this calculation yourself, but what you will see is that you get something that looks like this in general. So you might think this is like really dumb, why would you bother with this sort of description? But what's really cool is that now Alice has this description of just her own state, and she can do whatever she likes to it. She can evolve it, she can measure it or whatever, and she'll get exactly the same predictions as if she had access to this entire state and was doing all of these operations on her part of the state. So now you have a much smaller Hilbert space to deal with, and you don't need to have access to the entire state. You can just do everything that you want just on your own subsystem. So that's really useful. So let's now add this to our infographic. So, oh, okay. And one thing I didn't mention is that now we can introduce this terminology called mixed states versus pure states. And in general, density operators or density matrices represent mixed states, while state vectors exclusively represent pure states. And we can characterize how pure or how mixed something is with this quantity called the purity. And the purity is defined as the trace of the density matrix squared. And so, can you see that that's a capital P? Well, let's just say purity equals trace of rho squared. So if purity is equal to 1, then we have a pure state. Otherwise, we say that the state is mixed. And if the purity is equal to 1 on D, where D is the dimension of the Hilbert space, then we say that it's maximally mixed. And so if we have a state that, like this state, which I said before, it's maximally entangled, then the consequence of that is that the density matrix corresponding to one subsystem is going to be maximally mixed. So you can actually use the purity of your subsystem to characterize how entangled the system was to begin with. If they're completely separable, then your subsystem is going to be a pure state and your purity is going to be one. But don't worry about remembering all of that. It's going to be introduced again in September. Okay, so here this is just for pure states. And we can do the same thing for mixed states. Okay, so now instead of having the state psi, we have a density matrix. And we still want to ensure that it's normalized. So the normalization condition for a density matrix is that the trace is equal to one. And we also have this notion of purity, where the trace of the density matrix squared is going to range between the value 1 and 1 on D, where D is the dimension of the Hilbert space. And when it's equal to that, we say that it's pure. And when it's equal to that, we say that it's maximally mixed. Okay. And then we can also describe unitary evolution on that state. But now we say that rho prime is given by a unitary acting from both sides. And again, it needs to satisfy this condition to make sure that it's unitary. And we can do the same thing for measurement. So again, measurement is given by these operators, which are projectors. They satisfy this property. But now the probability of getting outcome M is going to be given by the trace of the density matrix and the projector PM. And the density matrix given outcome M is going to be given by the projector acting on the density matrix from both sides. And then we normalize by, now, rather than it being the square root of the probability, it's just the probability, because you've got the square root coming from the ket and the square root coming from the bra. And you can convince yourself that if you put in a pure state for a density matrix, so let's say if you say that the density matrix is just one term, so it's an outer product like that, you'll be able to recover exactly those expressions there. Yes?
Double check. When you've written P of M, it's the trace of rho times P, mm-hmm. and in the upper one, that's the expectation value, right? Not the probability.
It's the same.
isn't an expectation value what you expect to measure, whereas the probability is the probability that you would measure that expectation value?
But it's not like you're measuring an observable. It's only one term in that observable. So the expectation value of getting one outcome is just the probability of getting that outcome. That's probably said poorly. Maybe what you can do is to convince yourself that that's okay is to look at the spectral decomposition for an observable and then calculate what you would think is the expectation value of that observable. And what you'll get out is a sum of probabilities times the outcome, which is what you'd expect, where the probabilities are given by that expression there. Maybe we can just do that. Let's see if I can do it on the fly. So we have a observable, which is given by its spectral decomposition. Well, okay, yeah, I probably didn't tell you that. Did I write it like that? I've just erased it, but is that how I gave the spectral decomposition? Yeah. So if PM satisfies all of those properties, then it means I can write this as that. And so now if I want to look at the expectation value of the observable, I would get something that looks like, or maybe it doesn't, I don't even need that. And this is what you would expect as the definition of an expectation value, right? So it makes sense that this corresponds to the probability of getting outcome M. Okay, so where do we want to go now? Okay, so we've got a situation where Alice's state was entangled with Bob's. Bob is at the pub, so she can't use his help to characterize her state, but fortunately she has a density matrix formalism, and so she can actually write down everything she needs to know about her state. And she can evolve her state, she can measure it, and that's great. But all of this assumes that she's just doing operations on her own state. But what if there's something else going on and there's an operation that's continuing to evolve both of the states together? So it's a joint operation. Can Alice still describe the consequences of that just on her own system? And of course the answer is yes, otherwise I wouldn't be bringing it up. So I will show you what Alice can use to describe joint unitary evolution just in terms of what's happening to her own system. So let's again start off with Alice has her state A, Bob has his state B. And of course, we're going to eventually try and come up with a density matrix, so we'll already write this as an outer product. And now there's some sort of unitary evolution going on that may be entangling these two states. And since we're interested in what's happening only to Alice's system, we're going to now trace out Bob's system. So this will give us Alice's system after it's evolved. Maybe I want to give this a title. Okay, so the trace is going to be defined as the sum of all of the partial trace is defined as the sum of all of the diagonal elements for just the B system. And now I'm just going to define an operator. AK as something that looks like that. And so it looks kind of weird, but you can see that here we have a operator that is on system A and B. Here we have Bras and Ketz on system B. So they're going to just get rid of any of the Ketz here that correspond to system B and just give us complex numbers. And so overall, this operator is only going to be an operator acting on system A. And you can do that yourself. You can convince yourself that that's true. So then, using that definition, I can rewrite this as just in terms of these operators, AK, acting on system A. And so it's almost like unitary evolution, except we have more than one term. And these operators now no longer have to be unitary. In fact, they're not going to be unitary. And so what this allows us to do is now have a system that's just Alice's system and describe non-unitary dynamics. So if you remember the block sphere that, I don't know if any of you got to the block sphere question at the end of yesterday's tutorial, but the block sphere is a nice way of representing two-level systems. And the general state that I gave you was only a pure state. And so those pure states, they just live on the surface of the block sphere. But now if I take a pure state and I evolve it in general, according to this non-unitary dynamics, it can leave the surface of the sphere and, you know, go inside and do interesting things inside. I can also start off with a state that's completely mixed and apply this non-unitary dynamics and purify it. So this gives us a much more general description of our two-level systems that you couldn't do just with unitary dynamics. And so a good example of, yes?
I'm a bit confused. I think that if in the first equation, if we go, the trace is invariant and under rotation. And if we do that, wouldn't like U dagger U just become?
It would, but if this was a full trace, but because the trace is only on system B, but this operator is an operator on A and B, then you can't use this cyclic property of the trace. If you had something that was just an operator on B, then you could do that. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so a nice example of this type of dynamics is spontaneous emission. So you have a two-level atom, let's say it's excited, and then over time it's going to decay to the ground state. And so I could even, rather than starting so let's say I have like a mixed state, which is going to be a okay, so I have a density matrix that represents my two-level atom prepared in a state where it's a classical probabilistic mixture of being on the ground and excited state. So the way that you would describe that using a density matrix is something like this. And on your Bloch sphere, it's a maximally mixed state, and it would lie somewhere in the middle of the Bloch sphere. And your intuition tells you that no matter if, so let's say this is ground and this is excited. So no matter what sort of state I prepare, over time, it's going to spontaneously emit and end up in the ground state. So I'm increasing the purity of the state because it's getting closer to the surface of the sphere. And so it seems like a really weird type of dynamics, but what's actually happening is that our two-level system is system A, and the electromagnetic field is system B. And so you actually have unitary dynamics on the entire system. You have a unitary that couples the two-level system and your electromagnetic field, and everything's happening unitarily. The energy is being transferred from your two-level atom into a photon that goes off into the field. But if you're just looking at the two-level atom and ignoring what's happening in the field, it looks like there's non-unitary dynamics happening on the atom. So rather than having to treat, you know, this entire universe, if you want to just describe what's happening to your atom alone, you can use this formalism to describe the non-unitary dynamics. And you'll find in the literature that these operators are called Krauss operators. Sometimes it's called the operator sum formalism, whatever. But I think in the September course, Joe refers to them as Krauss operators. Okay, so now, we will continue with our infographic. So now we're going to talk about open systems. So I'm using the terminology open system because we're only concentrating on a subsystem, system A, which is interacting with the rest of the world, system B. So the density matrix stays the same. Because really we were kind of already thinking about the density matrix as being an open system. And our evolution now is going to be given by the Krauss operators. But we have to ensure that the dynamics on the entire system is unitary. So the way that we do that is we impose a condition on these operators, which says that, let me get the dagger right. That the sum of A dagger A has to equal the identity. Okay, so we discussed joint evolution, but now I'm going to consider the situation where, so Bob is like sick of being at the pub and he decides to come home, and now he wants to start measuring his state, right? And he gets all sorts of outcomes. And so the question is, can we describe what's happening to Alice's state while Bob is making measurements on the state? And so I'm saying joint measurement because the formalism that I'm developing here could be used to describe joint measurements on the system. But what I will specifically show you only corresponds to the case where Bob is making measurements, but I'm describing the effects of that on Alice's system. Okay, so I mean, we're pretty much going to follow the same thing as we did here. But actually, I erased this. Okay, so what is our situation? We have, again, our state, Alice, Bob. We're writing it as a density matrix. We're going to assume that there was some sort of unitary evolution that coupled the two systems together. I'm saying that because if there wasn't any unitary evolution and they were separable, then whatever Bob did to his state wouldn't actually affect Alice's at all. So to get some sort of effect on Alice's state, we want to entangle them with this unitary. And now we're going to say that Bob measured his state. So I'm going to write the measurement operator corresponding to the outcome M as this outer product, which is satisfied. So PM can always be written as that because it satisfies the conditions that we wrote up there. So Bob is making his measurement, but Alice is not doing anything. So I'm just going to describe that as the identity on her state. I probably didn't even need to write down the identity because, I mean, in the other calculations, we were assuming it's implicitly there, but it's okay to have it. Okay, so we had our two states, they got entangled, Bob is making his measurement, and we would like to know what is the probability that we got outcome M. And we want to ask that question given knowledge only of Alice's state before the measurement. So the probability we know is going to be given by the trace, because at the moment everything is, you know, still just written in terms of what we have. It's still an open, a closed system because I'm considering both systems. So I can just use the formalism in that box there. So the probability of outcome M is given by the trace. Okay, and now I'm going to do a quick trick where I say that the trace over the entire system is the same as a trace over system A and a trace over system B. So I'll just rewrite this as trace over system B, trace over system A. And now I explicitly evaluate the trace over system B. So I write trace over system A, and then I have a sum over K. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good question, because I know what answer I'm going to get. But it's okay because a projector is what's called idempotent, so it's equal to itself times two.
So we define a length because we are doing the two trees, like we will kind of use the same.
Exactly, because I mean, I've now written it as A and B, but it was actually a trace over the entire system. So I now can make use of the, yeah, the property of the trace, the
so
cyclic property of the trace.
One of the projector to do the calculation, or you have very good purpose.
I have a good reason to do that, yeah. Which are, I mean, so it's essentially it's going to be the same thing as I did here, where I'm going to have an operator on the left and an operator on the right, and I want that operator to be the transpose of itself, and so I want to make sure that everything looks symmetric on the left side and the right side. Yeah. Are you asking because you don't want to write it down? I also don't want to write it down, so hopefully you understand what I'm doing here. Okay, and now I define an operator. Which we'll end up calling the measurement operator. And it will be given by, okay, so what will happen here? So this K is going to act on this M. And so I'll get a delta function between the K and the M, and so that'll get rid of this sum. So I'll only have this M left over. And then my operator UAB. And then I'll have this guy. Yeah. And so with this definition, I can now write this as the probability of getting outcome M is the trace over A measurement operator M on system A. And then M dagger on the other side. So now I can formulate my measurement scheme in terms of these operators and only describe what's happening on Alice's system. And so actually, let me first write down everything. So our probability is going to be given by trace. And now I'm going to just define a new operator EM, which is called a POVM element. So you may have heard this terminology. One way people describe it is the POVM formalism. Sometimes they use generalized measurements. They all kind of mean the same thing. So this POVM element is equal to M dagger M. And there are reasons why you do this, because sometimes you only need to do calculations that depend on the POVM elements and you don't really care what the actual measurement operators are. So these measurement operators are more to do with how you physically realize the actual measurement, but you might want to, you know, come up with some sort of, I don't know, scheme that only relies on your knowledge of the EMs. So you can, you know, write a whole paper or something dealing with just the EMs, show that you can do something interesting, and then an experimentalist comes in and says, well, if I want to actually make an experiment and realize these EMs, I need to know what measurement operators it corresponds to, and so now I'll, you know, think about this. But that'll become more clear in the September course. Okay, so I can write my probability in terms of these POVM elements. and I don't need to know what the measurement operators are, I just need to know what the EM is. But if I want to make a statement about the post-measurement state, then I do actually need to know which measurement operators are being used to implement my POVM. And so I then write the density matrix given outcome M is going to be given by this expression. Okay. So here we have, and we need some more things. The POVM elements all need to sum to one. Okay, so what I've written down there in the measurement box, that is the formalism that's used to describe generalized measurement. And so it's not just used for the case where that I've described here, where Bob is just measuring his system. It could describe joint measurements on the system. It could describe things like weak measurements, which we haven't talked about, but you might encounter people talking about weak measurements. And pretty much any measurement that you can think of can be described using that formalism. And so one thing I haven't mentioned at all is the situation where you're trying to do unitary evolution, or you're trying to make a projective measurement, but there's some sort of, you know, a truck is driving past your lab or something, you know, some sort of thing is messing with your experimental apparatus. And in that case, what you would have to do is describe your evolution as a probabilistic mixture of different types of unitary evolutions. So, you know, the evolution that you wanted, and then some slight deviation from that, and then some other slight deviation. Or you're trying to make some sort of measurement that's projective, but due to fluctuations, you should describe it as a probabilistic mixture of projective measurements. And so both of those cases can be described using this open system formalism as well. So there you would have your AKs would actually correspond to unitaries that have been scaled by the square root of the probability of that unitary happening. And similarly with the measurement operators, they can be described as POVMs that have been scaled by the probability of it happening. And so typically when people introduce things like density density matrices can be represented as probabilistic mixtures of pure states. So that's another thing. So usually people introduce all of these concepts, talking about like classical mixtures of different things happening. And I think that's how Joe does it as well. And I don't think one way is better than the other, but it's nice kind of to see things from a different perspective. And so I wanted to kind of take the backwards approach and motivate everything in terms of reduced systems when you're doing something on, you know, on a composite system. I think I had a couple of more things I wanted to say. Oh, okay. And so the postulates that I wrote down, they were specifically the postulates for isolated systems, projective measurements, and unitary dynamics. But you can completely reformulate the postulates to correspond to this open systems formulation. So I believe Joe will actually go through that explicitly. It's just a matter of rewriting the postulates to include that. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say. I wanted to first ask you whether you have any other questions. And if not, I have a exercise that I want you guys to do. It's kind of a homework exercise, but it's not really a homework exercise because I would like you to do it before the tutorial, so it's kind of like a lunchtime exercise. But it's not hard, but it's mandatory. It's absolutely mandatory, and I'm going to make sure that you guys do it. So what I would like is for you to come up with a question. So the question can be, I would like it to be to do with what we've discussed today. And it can be something like, you know, you just didn't understand what I said, so can you please explain this more clearly? Or it can be something that you've been inspired to ask based on what you've learned here. So it can be any range of questions. But you must absolutely come up with a question. There's no way that you don't have at least one question in your head. So I would like you to write that question down on a piece of paper and then scrunch it up so it's really small, so it's not clear what question corresponds to which person. And at the beginning of the tutorial, I'm going to come around with a box, and I'm going to make sure that each one of you throws something into the box. But I don't want to know who asked what question. I don't care, or whatever. And then what I want to do, you can, of course, do like a donkey vote. So you can throw in a blank piece of paper. That's fine. I can't tell if you do that. But you absolutely have to throw something in there. And so then what I will do is I will look at all the questions and make a list of them. And I guess you guys will be interested to see what questions other people have. But what I'll also do is give this to Joe Emerson before he starts his class, because it would be good for him to know what things you guys are interested in, and hopefully he'll be able to address all of those things in his course. And I'll make sure to do that and throw out the pieces of paper before I see any of your homework, so I can't compare handwriting or anything. So it's going to be completely anonymous. But please, over lunch, think about what sort of question you would like to ask. So I will see you at the tutorial at 3:45.